Today, we have Senator Green, Senator McGuire, Huggins, Stedman, and Willakowski, soon to be followed by Senator Wagner, who was here. I'd step out. Here he comes now. Today, in our continuing quest for information on a potential for gas line development, we have the Port Authority with us, and in this case, Mr. Bill Walker, who's a general counsel and project manager. And online, we have Mr. Radoslav Shipkoff, and Craig Richards is with us here. Craig, welcome. And we're scheduled today until 5:30. We'd like to wrap up by 5, if at all possible, but be that as it may, take it away.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for this opportunity. We really appreciate the opportunity to come before you and present our project, present sort of a status report of where we are.
But just put yourself on the record so we're
For the record, Bill Walker. I'm the general counsel project manager for the Alaska Gasoline Port Authority. Much has happened in the last couple of months in our efforts to build a gas line. Some have asked us of recent, are you still alive? And they've actually said that. And we said, absolutely, we're still alive. We were alive in 1999 before the Stranded Gas Act. We were before the AGEA. We will continue to do what we do until there's a gas line. That's our mission. That's our passion. Some say there's a lot of things we don't have, and they're correct. But one thing we have a lot of is we have a lot of passion for this issue. We have a board of directors that stretches from the North Slope Borough to Fairbanks, North Star Borough, and City of Valdez. We have 9 members of the board. They all wish they could be here today. Their schedules not allow. It's a voluntary board. We have, over the years, the municipalities have put in about $1.5 million into this effort, and we have gone out and matched it with about $20 million from the private sector. We're pleased we've not needed to come before you and ask for funding. We have allowed the private sector to step forth and provide that function, and that to us was sort of a way of testing and being sure that there was a viable project. If companies weren't willing to step up and put in $8 or $10 million, we're wondering if how serious they are about working with us. So that's where we obtained our funding, and we think that has been the appropriate avenue of funding. Today, I'm not going to go into a lot about our past, about who we are and how we were formed. And we've been before your committee, thank you very much, a number of times. And so I don't think, given the time constraints, I'm going to spend a lot of time about how we were formed and whatnot. I think that will come out somewhat in my testimony today. As you mentioned, Radoslav Shipkoff is online in Washington, D.C. Radoslav is our financial advisor with Greengate LLC. He has been in that capacity since 1999 with the Port Authority. He is the individual, his company has performed all of our financial modeling. And Craig Richards of our office is with us as well, and Craig will handle a few of the slides today that deal with some of the financial pieces as well as the Prudhoe Bay offtake and volume issue. The mission of the Port Authority has always been to build or cause to be built. That mission has been tested recently, and I will get into that a bit in my testimony of how that's been tested. It really is cause to be built. It's not about the Port Authority. It's not about that we have to be. It has to be our name on the pipe as it goes by. All we're about is that we believe it has to happen. We believe that the work that we have done, the consortium that we put together over the last 10 years, has proven its case. We think the AGEA process, let me just say up front, we think the AGEA process has been a very good thing. I sat here last year and we testified and said that we supported the process. What we believe it did, even though we are not in that process as we speak, it caused a mountains of information to come forth that we didn't have before, that we as Alaskans didn't have before. We have bids that came in that brought data in that we did not have available to us before. We as the Port Authority had always wanted to have a complete cost estimate, turnkey basis, as well as the financial market analysis together. One without the other, it doesn't work. You have to know how much it's going to cost to see if it's profitable, to see what the market is. So we have that data. The results are very exciting. The next slide I'm going to show you is really the real reason why we're continuing to stay in this game. This is what keeps us as a board to continue to push this project forward. If at any time someone was able to convince us or came to us and said, you know, we've looked at your project and it's just not economically viable, we would look at this issue. We've not had that happen to us. We've had companies that have withdrawn participation with us, and when I've asked them, is it because of the economics, they are very quick to say it is absolutely not because of the economics. You have a very, very strong economics in your project. So this slide is one that we think tells the whole story of why we continue to push for this, for the All-Alaska project. It may be a little bit of a surprise to see that a net back on a project that is a 2.7 BCF of volume of gas has a higher wellhead value than a project of 4.5. That is clearly a function of the markets you're looking at. What we have done in the way of markets is we have assumed that, first of all, any gas that leaves Alaska is going to leave, is our first preference is to be consumed within Alaska. Realistically, we need to export it, either export it across the border into Canada or export it into the Asian market or some other location in order to be able to use it ourselves first. So what we have done, we've assumed in our economic model is that the shippers of the gas will want to take it to the best market. We just had made that assumption. We have slides that talk about market optionality. Basically, we are able to put gas into, with the All-Alaska line, into six different markets. So we think market optionality is important. We think that we look at projects elsewhere in the world and how they have begun their projects. We haven't found one that has started with the largest piece of it first. Most of them start with the smallest piece they can do first and add to it. I guess the clearest example is gutter gas 1, 2, and 3, ultimately 4. I mean, they don't start off with a huge volume. They start off with the smallest volume that's economically viable to begin that process. We think that's what we do. I believe it's unusual, very highly unusual, that you, in this situation, that Alaska has the opportunity to start off with a smaller project with a higher wellhead price. I think that's the uniqueness of what LNG allows you to do, to take advantage of rural markets and not just a single market where a pipeline hub might be. During this presentation, questions, I'm happy to be interrupted if that's your wishes. I have no problem with that.
Okay, good. And let the record show that Senator Stevens has joined us.
In preparation for our bid and this, and working with this project, we've worked with Bechtel since 1999. Putting our bid together and the project together, Bechtel has expended approximately $10 million towards that effort. Much of that was done in 2000, 99 and 2000, 2003 through 2005, continuing to update our project model and the cost estimate. The most recent was the final cost estimate update for 2007 for this application. The vast majority of our application is work that was performed by Bechtel. They had approximately 50 engineers in Houston that worked on this project. It was a very a significant sized team within the Bechtel headquarters. I spent most of my summer in Houston, Houston, Texas. I'd rather have been the other Houston. But I was very impressed. I mean, I've always been impressed with the work that Bechtel has done, and they've been a dream to work with on our standpoint. They have been up here several times, made presentations to the legislature. We're very pleased with what they performed.
Mr. Walker, the Bechtel cost estimate, what's the effective date of that?
2007. As of November 30th, as of the date of the bid submittal. Our prior work was 2000, then they updated in 2005, and there was a complete update in 2007. And it's down to the point. I did have slides in here that showed every pipe yard, storage location, number of miles of pipe, each of the construction camps on the route, the number of beds per camp. I felt that was not of particular interest to you, so I have chosen to delete that. But we have more detail than you'd ever want to see. A total of 15,000 pages is what we turned in on November 30th. So I chose not to bring all that with me. As you can see, the pipeline cost estimate is approximately $12 billion for the pipeline. $7 billion for the LNG facilities for liquefaction. We have assumed a third party on the gas conditioning plant, and that would be we have a toll built into our tariff for the gas conditioning. This is our project. You've seen this slide before. You probably haven't seen it with the offtake locations. Our project consists of obviously the All-Alaska Gas Line, an 806-mile pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, parallel to the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. It would be a 2.7 BCF project, chilled gas, chilled to 28 degrees Fahrenheit. The gas conditioning plant, of course, is the first piece on the North Slope. And that would be an oversized. We realize that 2.7 BCF in a 48-inch line is significantly under capacity, and so we have we would oversize the gas conditioning facilities. The liquefaction in Valdez, of course, would be at the terminal site that's been approved by FERC at the Anderson Bay that Yukon Pacific has obtained. I have a slide on that, but. Those are the main pieces of our project, but we did put in showing the offtake locations of where the we would anticipate offtake would be for the gas. What we did is we actually I know that it was the minimum required was 5, but what we did was something a little different. The process we used, we contacted entities between Prudhoe Bay and Valdez. We contacted every military base. We contacted villages. We contacted industrial entities and said, would you be interested in gas coming off this line? And without exception, they all said, of course, we would. We actually at one point had 22, and I was able to convince our team to narrow it down to 18. I thought we were just getting perhaps too many. I see other applicants have offtake points in British Columbia in Northwest in Whitehorse area at the Burwash Landing. So I guess my philosophy is Burwash Landing gets an offtake point. I'm happy to have offtake points that we have the location. I guess the point we're trying to make is that our goal really is to have as many offtake points as possible. We want to have the gas distributed as much as we can through Alaska. Some have said our project or plan or looks like a porcupine as far as the number of offtake points, and we're happy to have that. That comment, because that's what we want it to be. We want it to go both ways. We know that the Otna Corporation is exploring successfully for and developing their land for gas. We'd like them to be able to put that gas into the pipe, as well to be able to get that to a market. The obvious ones are the offtake at Glen Allen, the spur line into the South Central area, and we've made provisions for a spur line into Canada as well. At a later date, there's some question about which one's a spur line. We're pretty comfortable with our project going first because of the size. As you will see, we have oversized it to a Delta Junction at 48 inch to Delta Junction. At Delta Junction, it's dropped down to 42 inch from there. So our plan is, when you start off with 2.7 BCF. Of gas, you have plenty of room for additional expansion through compressors. We start off with virtually 3 compressors. I mean, our first compressor is a gas conditioning plant at Prudhoe Bay. In essence, when it comes out, it'll come out with pressure at that location. We have 2 additional compressor stations. One is approximately 100 miles north of Fairbanks, and another one is about 100 miles north of Glen Allen. And
Senator White has a question.
A couple of questions, Mr. Chairman. What pressure is your line going to operate at?
We operate at 2,200
PSI. And who is going to pay the cost of all these little amounts of gas in the offtake sites that are listed here?
Well, that would have the pay for that would have to be those that are taking the gas off. We imagine there would be some sort of a local distribution system would be created for that to come off, and we assume that would be a necessary piece of for it to come out.
Did anybody tell these people how much it was going to cost to reduce the pressure of that gas and odorize it and distribute it?
No, we did not. We basically started off with, is there interest? And it was couched in the terms of, and actually in our application, we referred to 9 sort of centralized distribution centers, because many of these could be in one center, and the distribution may be more economic to push the gas out in distribution system rather than the additional offtake, individual offtakes. Fewer offtakes, but more of a distribution system. So that's a calculation that we have not completed yet. We initially wanted to find is there a need, is there an interest? And then we certainly found that there was a strong interest for that.
Thank you. Two questions. Number one, what is the cost to offtake the gas? What do you expect charging in state use? Were you anticipating using distance sensitive rates? That's question number one. Question two is, with 18 offtake points, what do you expect the amount of gas to be available at Valdez to be?
Now, Senator Witkowski, through the chair, the offtake points. Let me answer your second question first. The volume of gas, the maximum we believe would be used in state would be 0.5 BCF. We think that's the standard amount that's been used as far as what in-state consumption would be. So that's sort of the rule of thumb that we have used. What we have used for the offtake
I'm just curious. I mean, let's say someone in Yukon River, a village, or a Bettles says, I want to offtake an MCF. I mean, what do you charge? You charge Henry Hub, or I mean, how are you going to set the rates?
No, the rate that we have set forth in our application, it would be an absolute distance sensitive rate. In other words, the fewer miles of a distance in the pipeline, the lesser the rate would be. So that would be, in other words, if you go past a compressor station, the cost of that would be included in your rate. If it was before that, it would be a lesser rate. So it would be a true distance sensitive rate rather than a zone for the entire state.
So Alaskans would get it at cost? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we don't control the price of the gas. Obviously, we would be merely a facility infrastructure to move the gas. It would be what the rate would be set for the gas. The proposal, as far as all we could propose, would be the rate for the charge for the transportation of the gas, and that would be a distance sensitive rate.
Thank you, and welcome, Senator Thomas.
I'll talk a little bit about the three. We've broken up our project into 4 different pieces. Rather than looking at it as a 24 billion cubic foot project, billion dollar project, we've said let's break that up into pieces that may be a bit more manageable. The first piece is the gas conditioning plant at Prudhoe Bay. We have looked at that with private entities. We think that's one piece of it that can be done in state companies. We think the regional corporations are natural for that. We have had several meetings with them. There seems to be a strong interest for them to take on that piece. I guess the attitude that we have is maybe we should find out what we can do ourselves before we assume that it has to be done by companies in the lower 48. And there's nothing, I have nothing against companies in the lower 48, but I do have a strong preference that we try to do what we can ourselves as much as we can before we reach out to someone else. So that was their desire as well. There's some incredible tax benefits by whoever owns and operates the gas conditioning plant. Those should stay, we think those benefits should remain in Alaska and benefit Alaskan corporations, not necessarily a corporation from outside of Alaska.
Senator Wagner, can you expound on your tax credits?
Accelerated depreciation, I should say, not rather than tax credits.
Okay.
They have accelerated depreciation that goes with the as part of the 2004 federal energy, the energy bill, federal energy act provides for accelerated depreciation, which some have looked at that and said that's a significant advantage to be able to do that. So, again, we think that's an inappropriate piece to have separate. We have given some thought about having the producers as the owner and operator of that, and that's certainly a possibility. Although some have said it's maybe better to have somebody independent and not have someone that's a producer having that piece of it as a potential gatekeeper of access to that facility. So our first choice, struggled with which to go with. The board feels a local company, an Alaskan company. Much has happened since we built the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. You know, company Alaska has matured and grown, and let's see how much of this. When we say all Alaskan, we truly mean all Alaskan in every shape and form. So that's how we would handle the gas conditioning facility. There's been a lot of discussion about in the past about the transportation of LNG, Jones Act issues, etc. So I put this in because I think it merits a little bit of time. Our project is a project that allows a shipper that puts gas into the pipeline at Prudhoe Bay to take it to pretty much any place in the world they want to take it to. If they want to take it to the west coast of the U.S., they can do that. If they want to take it into a receiving terminal in Costa Azul, which is a Sempra facility, they would be. We want them to be able to do that. Actually, we are participating in an open season of that facility, an expansion of that facility. If they want to take it into British Columbia through the Kitimat facility, they could do that with the shipping arrangement that we have. So, and if they want to take it to the Asian market or any place else, they could do that with these ships. The company that we have a teaming agreement with, there's the advantage of them is twofold. One is they have 8 U.S. built LNG tankers. They are tankers that are currently have been reflagged out of the U.S., so they're U.S. bottom, foreign flagged. And we have spent some time in Washington, D.C. to determine the process and how difficult to reflag those back into U.S. We have participated in the owners of the vessels have retained a law firm in Washington, D.C. to look specifically at that. We have been advised by staff of our delegation that is not a big ask to reflag a U.S.-built vessel, because what you're doing is you are putting U.S. workers to work on the ship, because it would be U.S.-flagged, U.S.-crewed, U.S.-owned. So you're not taking any jobs away from anybody. You're actually providing jobs. So they say that's not a difficult thing to do. As we sit here today, they are not in U.S. flag, but they are U.S. bottom, and that's the most critical piece of that. So that would be available for the shipment of LNG from Alaska, from Valdez to the West Coast or points in between along the Pacific Coast. On the those that would want to ship the LNG to the Asian market, they have the Mitsui OSK Lines is the largest in the world. They have approximately 645 ships, 80 of which are LNG tankers. They are the largest owner of LNG tankers in the world. So we're very comfortable with their technology. They have been to Alaska, obviously, and are familiar with the requirements of shipping. They've looked at the information we have on the terminal site. They're very pleased with the depth of the water. We have no issues on the shipping. I mean, in the past there's been frequent reference to the Jones Act, and we have taken that seriously, and that's why we have a teaming agreement with the with Mitsui OSK Lines.
Yeah, Mr. Walker, in that respect, it sounds as though you're assuming an export permit.
We are assuming that the export permit that's currently in existence would remain in existence, the one that has been obtained by Yukon Pacific Corporation. I spoke with the attorney in Washington, D.C. that obtained that permit for them and went through the process for that. He said he has no reason to think that there's no time limit on that. It doesn't expire. It doesn't have to be renewed. I'm sorry, it does expire. It expires 25 years after the first shipment of LNG. But he's not aware of a technicality that would have to go and reapply and renew a number of the permits, and I'll get to that in a bit. We have had to renew. We had to every year. We pay the fee for the state right of way and the federal right of way. We renewed this year with FERC the LNG terminal license at Anderson Bay and Valdez. That's every 3 years you have to renew that. So we renewed that in May of this year. So, but the export license appears to be as good as it was the day that ink dried.
I've asked several questions, different people, about the export license. But has anybody asked the Department of Energy about the export license and the validity of that license today, especially based upon a project that would use the federal guarantee on the loan? Has there been anything put in writing that says, yes, we will still allow you to export that gas even though it's being processed and made available to market by the use of $18 billion in federally guaranteed loans?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, we have assumed that you couldn't do both. We have assumed that we've had many meetings with the Department of Energy on the loan guarantee, to the point I'm convinced that you could not export and utilize the loan guarantee. I think that would be an uphill battle. So in our application, in our model, we have assumed there would not be a federal loan guarantee for that very reason, Senator.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Walker, jumping back to your affiliation, do you have a declared affiliation with a pipeline company to do the pipeline piece?
We do not at this time.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You know, I want to address the issue of AGEA a bit. I don't want to dwell on it. We tend to move forward and not necessarily look back too much. But we have gone through a process on AGEA that I think that since we were here last year and testified in favor of it, I think that we owe an explanation of what happened to us. And I think that the media has done a good job of explaining the circumstance that we found ourselves in. But I wanted to firsthand, one thing about the media is you read the paper, but you can't ask a question. So I want to sort of restate it, and I don't want to take very much time because that's not really where the heart of this presentation is. But on the other hand, I think it warrants some time with your permission, Mr. Chairman. When AGEA passed, we immediately headed south to the lower 48 to put together a consortium. Our concept initially always has been to put together a consortium. As you said, Mr. Chairman, the pipeline company would be a wonderful person sitting next to it. We began that process in June, and we were very pleased with the response we received. I mean, there were companies that, one in particular on the pipeline side, that looked at AGEA. They looked at the information on Prudhoe Bay, which is fairly well known, that which is public. They looked at the Yukon Pacific permits, looked at the process, and they said, "Boy, this is good. We're very pleased with what we've seen." I was in June. They came up. Many trips to Alaska, and we sat down and began negotiations. They liked it so much, they said, in fact, we'd like to do the whole thing. Work exclusively with us, and we'll worry about the LNG later. But let's work with us on a pipeline to Valdez, and we'll find an LNG piece of it. And we said, no, we think we need an LNG piece of it as well. It needs to be a piece of a pipeline and a liquefaction at the same. And so we went out to find an LNG company to put together with a pipeline company. Ultimately, we put that together. We had a very significant pipeline company, and we had a very significant LNG company. At one point, they decided that perhaps they would like to do that separate from the Port Authority. In other words, they liked very much the data that we had with Bechtel. They said, the work you have with Bechtel is excellent. We'd like to be able to take that and update that, and we'd like to do that sort of on our own. So that's when the Port Authority, the board, had to make that tough decision I talked about earlier, build or cause be built. We looked at these companies and said, boy, these are big companies. We want a gas pipeline. And you know, if we step out of the way and someone goes by us with a gas pipeline, we'll buy champagne as they go by. We'd be very happy to have that result. So we said, that's fine, under one condition. If you don't bid, give the data back to us, updated data, so we can make sure we submit a bid. And they said, well, why wouldn't we do that? We said, well, I don't know. We want that. That's what we want. We can't force you to submit a bid with our data, but if you take our data, we want to be able to get it back. So if you aren't going to bid, we will be able to do that. You know, that's about the same time as and I didn't pay much attention, and that's my fault, to an article that ran in the Petroleum News on August 12th of 2007. The article was quoted David Sokol. And David Sokol's quote was, he talked about Mid-America bidding, submitting a bid, and of course we're watching this fairly closely because we want to make sure to see who's bidding and whatnot. And he said that they were going to submit a bid, but he couldn't believe the kind of pressure he was under not to submit a bid. In that article interview, he would not divulge who the partners were. He said, I will not divulge who the partners are because I don't want them to be under the same kind of pressure that we're under. I didn't fully appreciate what he was saying, and I have to sort of read between the lines because it doesn't come out specifically and say it, but there was a lot of pressure. So we continued on with this consortium, providing data and information. Everything we had was available to them. They came up, went through all the Yukon Pacific permits, and everything was fine until the middle of October. And I received a call, and the pipeline entity was going to withdraw. I said, well, that's certainly your choice, and we appreciate the work you've done to date, and I would like to obtain back our data, our own data. That we certainly had time to take what had been put together and put the bid together. And they chose not to do that. They said, no, we're not going to provide that data to you. The LNG company said, well, we're thinking about maybe submitting a bid, maybe not. Maybe we'll let AGEA fail. We're not sure what we're going to do. And so we were in a situation that we didn't have our own data. We had turned that over to these companies to put together their bid. After the LNG company said they would bid, so we put in our bid on November 30th, referencing their bid. So an odd way of doing it, but we had nothing else to do. They had our data. As it turns out, they didn't submit a bid. And we didn't find that out until the day of, the next day we discovered who submitted the bid. Well, that makes a bad situation worse, and makes us pretty upset, very upset. So at that point, we became very aggressive with them. They finally provided the data to us. When we received the letter from the state asking for additional information, they pointed out areas of our bid that was deficient, and we knew it was deficient. My goodness, I mean, we knew better than anybody it was deficient, but we bid with the best data we had available to us, which was not very much because we'd already turned our data over to the other companies. They ultimately provided it to us, and in responding to the state's letter for additional information, we could have done one of two things. We could have gone in and put the minimum amount of information in that would have just complied with our original bid, or we would have submit the best information we had available to us. And we said, our goal isn't to necessarily be successful at AGEA. Our goal is to build a gas pipeline, or have a gas pipeline built. So we said, no, we're going to submit the best data we have. And at that point, I mean, that second slide was what caused us to do that. If we hadn't submitted the data we did, we couldn't have put that slide up there that showed what the wellhead advantage was for an all-Alaska project. So we made the decision. I certainly will take responsibility if anybody's looking for someone to shoulder that. They said, we are going to put forth the best information we had. That's the first time in 10 years we had all the cost estimates down to the final wrench and all the market data. I mean, put together by leading companies around the world. We said, that's what we're going to submit. And we submitted that. We gained access to that Friday night on the 15th of December in Houston, and it was due on the 18th at 2:00, and we made that deadline. We took that work and we worked around the clock. Craig was in Houston, flew it back, and we put that application together. We're very proud of the application that we submitted on the 18th. It was submitted before anything became public to anybody else. There was no advantage for any other. We had no advantage because of what we submitted it with a supplemental request from the administration. So I'm not making excuses for the circumstance we found ourselves in. We found us in that circumstance for one reason only. We were doing what we thought was best for the state of Alaska. We thought these companies coming in using our data to submit the bid. I called the pipeline company just the minute I got word that they were going to withdraw, and I said, "Is it the economics? I mean, if it is, I'd be the first one would like to know if you're withdrawing because of the economics." He said, absolutely not. He said, the economics are fine. He said, it's just a business decision that we have to make and we have to withdraw, and I respect that. The LNG company, working with them, working up into the last 30 days of the bid process, their comments to me is the economics continue to get better and better. And now I know what they were saying. I didn't know at the time because I didn't see this data. Now that we have it and that we put it together and it's been put together for us, we see why they were saying it gets better and better. So we never would have thought that that the smaller project would have a in the range of a dollar advantage to the wellhead than the larger project. So that's the sort of the short version of what happened to us.
Do you have a, did you have some sort of confidentiality agreement with the LNG and pipeline companies that prohibits you from disclosing which companies they were?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we do. We do. I'm not convinced that that confidentiality agreement really is as strong as it was when it was initially put together, because I'm not sure it anticipated this type of treatment. But our goal is to advance a pipeline project. We can't. So I have not shared publicly the names of who it was that we worked with. We benefited from that relationship. Strangely enough, we benefited to the tune of about $2 million of work that they put forth to have our data updated. So, we are not. For a number of reasons, we're not mentioning the names of the companies that we work with. It was unfortunate for all parties that we ended up where we were. We, in some ways, benefited because we sit here with an absolute complete project down to the final nuts and bolts. So,
do you have any? What's your understanding as to why they ultimately withdrew? Do you have any conclusion on that?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I don't. I can certainly speculate, but I don't have any hard data or information, and because of that, I would care not to speculate. I'd rather focus on the path forward rather than what their motives were and what they did.
Other questions, Mr. Walker?
Mr. Walker, when your application was deemed non-compliant, I think that's the right term, is that correct? Non-conforming. Then you turned around and contested that. Could you just, were there 1, 2, 3, 4 bullets that you, under which you contested?
Yes, we did. Mr. Chairman, a couple things. First, let me, I don't want to go through this presentation without saying this. In our opinion, our application submitted at 2 o'clock on the 18th of December was fully compliant. I mean, it answered it. You know, it answered every question that was raised and had every piece that was necessary for a compliant application. But to your question on the request for reconsideration, AGEA has provision that says that we will not file an appeal. And I sat here, I think, in this chair, and I think in before this committee last year, and the question was, would we agree to that? And we did agree to that, that we would not file an appeal. We looked at the allowance under the Alaska law, the Alaska statute, Alaska Administrative Code, as far as reconsideration, and we felt that it was well within the commissioner's discretion to reconsider us if they chose to. So we felt that in what we set out, really, it wasn't that the administration had misread our first application. Our first application just wasn't. We were not. There were efforts to prevent us from bidding. It really is really what it came down to, and so we pointed that out. We provided to the administration copies of the correspondence between the withdrawn partners and ourselves to as evidence towards our effort to obtain that. We provided a copy of the draft complaint that I prepared ready to file in order to obtain that data. So we showed what we could show under a confidential arrangement evidence of that and pointed that out. So it wasn't that the administration didn't correctly interpret our first application. We knew our first application had some significant problems as a result of what had happened to us. But because we explained complied prior to anything becoming public, we gained no advantage whatsoever in this process by submitting it by the deadline they gave us of the 18th when they asked for additional information. They asked everybody for additional information. They told us that because we were not able to find the answer their questions from within our original application, they couldn't consider our second filing. So I hope that answers your question, but that was our contention, was that there was no advantage to us, and there's no disadvantage to another bidder, because we did not see what anybody else had bid, and so therefore I'm not sure how we could have been advantaged.
Other
Right. So as I recall, on the 30th of January, you received notification that your reconsideration had been disallowed.
That's correct.
And then there was a follow-on, because we had a briefing that essentially talked about a commitment to look at LNG course of action. But what sort of commitment was made to your organization at that point in time?
Mr. Chairman, we didn't actually have a commitment at that point in time. There was a communication that they were going to take a independent look at the LNG, and that didn't give us much comfort. And absolutely no dispersion against this administration, but the concern is that we have lived and breathed the All Alaska LNG project for 10 years, and to now sort of have some in-house sort of do an in-house analysis, I think straw man is the term that some have used, doesn't give us a lot of comfort that it's going to be an aggressive analysis. In other words, there are issues that perhaps they would interpret differently than we would. It makes a lot of difference what markets you go to. We suffered this in the last administration, where there was an analysis done to be able to compare it under the Stranded Gas Act, and then a company was retained out of the East Coast that did an analysis for $200,000 and never picked up the phone and called us. They analyzed our entire project and gave it somewhat of a negative slant without even contacting us. So maybe we're and that doesn't, you know, that one still is there, and so we're not overly excited about sort of a straw man analysis being done by the administration of an All Alaska project.
Right. So, but to make sure that we understand what your expectation is going forward, is that there's an analysis being done of the Canadian route, a Canadian route, not specifically TransCanada, and then an LNG course of action, maybe yours, maybe somebody else's, but assuming in the Sharp Group. Is that roughly correct for a baseline?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct from what I've understood is what their process is. We have now that we're outside of AGEA, we can sort of do some things that we couldn't do if we were in AGEA. So we have offered to work with the administration, provide our consultants, such as Radoslav Shipkov and others, make them available to the administration in that process, and that offer has been declined. So I'm not sure why, from the standpoint, we're not in AGEA. Although, while they were told the reconsideration is not allowed within AGEA, the side-by-side analysis that they're doing isn't either. So it's a little bit confusing to us as far as how they're doing one and they couldn't allow us to remain in the process. So we have some at the end of this presentation. I'm a big believer in if we have a concern, that we don't come and just deliver the concern. We come in and say, here's our concern, and here's a way forward we think is a way to proceed. So as part of this presentation, I want to do that, because we have always continued on after we reach a bump in the road by finding a way forward in doing that, and we think we have a solution for that.
Yeah, and now in that respect, just for a moment, just capitalizing on your expectations that you're still a player, which I support. But in that respect, you must visualize some scenario where oxygen is breathed back into your lungs for LNG going to Valdez. Could you tell us how you see that scenario unfolding?
I can. If with your indulgence, if I can wait to a couple
okay,
more slides,
good.
I have that well covered.
That's good.
We certainly didn't come here to tell you doom and gloom on the All Alaska Line. If we didn't have a way forward, we wouldn't take up your valuable time. So we do have that.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Okay. Proceed, please.
You know, one of the reasons I think perhaps we're so focused on this, that many of us were involved in this battle and on the TAPS issue in the 1970s, when the issue arose of whether or not the oil line would go through Canada or stay in Alaska, and we can all remember where we were on certain particular dates in Alaska's history, and the day of statehood, the announcement of that. Certainly the 64 earthquake, this was one for me. I was pouring concrete in Valdez on a state job, and we had the radio on listening to the votes that were coming in. And the concern was at that time, would TAPS go through Canada? And you know, the interesting is that I've looked back at those articles from that time, and the very same arguments made on keeping taps in Alaska are the very same arguments that we're saying of keeping the gas line in Alaska. We you know, the jobs, the value added, you know, the refineries that we have, if the pipeline had turned at Delta Junction, the oil line, and headed down to through Canada, much of the infrastructure in Alaska we wouldn't have, and much of the jobs. So we think that's it's worthy to look back at that, and we have, and that's one of the forces that keeps us going. Obviously, the significant pieces for the All Alaska Line, and these are pieces that we haven't just ourselves come about. It has to do with, I mean, others have recognized this as well and spoken very highly of it. Companies are very, very impressed with the amount of permitting that's been done by Yukon Pacific Corporation. I know that Wayne Lewis was here a week ago, and boy, he and Jeff Lohenfels, they have a 16-year history with that company, and I'm very impressed with what they have done. I have spent some time in the Yukon Pacific warehouse in Anchorage. A number of times companies come up and they want to go look at the data and whatnot, and we go through that. And I sort of marvel at the it's roughly $100 million of effort and work on gathering permits, the environmental data. It's very impressive, and others are very impressed with it. We've had 5 due diligence on the data, and we've yet to have one company come up and say there's no value to that. It's very important to us, obviously, to have infrastructure available for what we think it would be lower energy costs, and certainly the clean burning fuel issue. That certainly in the Fairbanks area is a significant issue, in other areas of the state as far as the emissions issue. And then the obvious is all the jobs remain in Alaska during the construction, operation, and maintenance. And we just think that that's a very significant, for a long time, we were always the economic stepchild of the various options, and we sort of used this as this sort of made up for that, is that, yeah, maybe we returned a little bit less to the wellhead, but by golly, we were going to go earlier, and that was that was Econ One's analysis for you that was very good, but also the jobs and whatnot. Well, now we have a higher wellhead, and we have all the jobs, and we're very excited about that that piece of it.
You know, if I might add, Mr. Walker, you know, one of the things that struck me when Mr. Van Meers was talking to us last October, and he essentially talked about the economic viability of going down through Canada at this point in time, which he says probably was not viable. And then he says, further went on to say that if there was a viable project, it was probably LNG. That would be his recommendation. So please.
Well, actually, that's correct. We certainly agree with that, and I think before your committee, and again, I want to thank this committee for inviting those that are not in GEO to see what you can learn. You heard from David Keene. I listened with great interest his testimony of saying that the LNG project would be the enabler for a highway project. You don't start with the largest and then add on the smallest. You start with the smallest, and then you add on from there. So he was very clear, and several times, and we couldn't agree with him more, is that the LNG is the, and for the reasons we state, this is exactly why the LNG would ultimately cause a later highway project to become economic. So, we think it's important for the value added piece of this for this project. We have watched what has happened in over the years and marveled at what they've done in Alberta with the access to liquids, and we think that's wonderful. We think that we should at least have that same opportunity in Alaska. We think that we should. We have had some benefit of that, certainly in the Kenai Peninsula, and we've had a taste for that. And I think that's the tip of the iceberg of what can be done in Alaska with the value added opportunity. We like the ability for Alaska to control our own destiny. We think that that's important. Rather than relying upon what happens in another country, a wonderful, friendly country, don't get me wrong, but we think that we can control our own destiny. We should do that ourselves. On the certainly the construction date, there's been some questions, some analysis, much analysis about how many years do the Yukon Pacific permits cut off of the process. The biggest number I've heard is 5 years. The smallest number I've heard is a year. So it's somewhere between a year and 5 years. We're not sure exactly where that is. In our application, we actually put the application in as though we didn't have those permits, just sort of a worst-case scenario, last quarter of 2017. But we know that that when you have permits that take 8 years to obtain, several of them, you have right-of-ways existing. I mean, you know, those saying we're going to have people in the field this year, we had people in the field 15 years ago in order to get the permits that they have. The All-Alaska line is pre-staked 65% of the way. I mean, when they ask the application, what route would you be going in the GEO application, we submitted alignment sheets. I mean, tons of alignment sheets saying exactly what side of what street it's going to go. I mean, it's that level of detail. So so we think that's a significant advantage. We think, as you'll see, and Craig will go through in more detail, the smaller project does not require all three producers. One thing we have always done is every project has always required all three producers, and that allows any one of the three producers to have the veto ability. So the advantage of the smaller project, it does not require all three producers. In fact, our project is 2.7. It's viable at 2 BCF. 2 BCF and some arrangements it can be the state and one producer. So that's very exciting. That it used to be that and Pedro Van Mueller would say, if you get a project down to, he used to use the term bite size. I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that, but to a bite-sized project, then you'll be able to win, because you're not having to get everybody to agree. If it required unanimous vote on city councils, on assemblies, on the legislature, it would be a very cumbersome process. That's kind of the process we think we've been in with the producers. It's always required all three to agree, and we've watched that process through for years of negotiation. That's a very difficult, and I'm not picking on the producers necessarily, but that's just a difficult thing because they all have their own individual business interests elsewhere in the world. Market optionality. We think it's imperative that we make available the most markets possible. We have six markets that we would have available with our project within the confines of the export license. Someone asked me recently, what market are you looking at? And my response was, the market that gets gas to Alaskans first. That's the market we're looking at. And that's the one that we think Alaska should look at. Because, you know, we talk about incentives. And I'll caution myself on this one, because I get a little bit carried away on the incentives, as far as all the incentives over the years that we have tried to put forth. You know, we get incentivized once a month. When we get our utility bills, we have the incentive to go and continue to do what we do. When we have people contact us by phone or by email and say, keep doing what you're doing, we're hoping that there's an All-Alaska project soon because of the circumstance that we're in right now. We are a large energy-producing state, and our energy costs are the highest in the nation. There's a disconnect for that. So we think the market optionality, we think that Alaska's gas should not be restricted in any way of where it should go. It should be restricted only by the laws that are in place today. We should be able to take our product to the market that is willing to pay us the highest price, quite honestly. And I don't think we should be ashamed of that. I don't think we have that limitation on our fish. And of course, this isn't fish. This is a natural resource that it doesn't come back every year. Once it's gone, it's gone. So I think we need to be sensitive to our needs and sensitive to our needs in Alaska, and not insensitive to needs of other locations, but I don't think we should restrict our ability to receive the highest price for our resource. I think that's what the Constitution demands, and I think we should stand by that. And the last bullet is the superior economics, the higher wellhead value, which we've gone over already. On the value added, I know that obviously, the Agrium plant is our biggest success story in the state, I believe, on value added. And I said before, I believe that's just the tip of what can be. And unfortunately, as we know, that is not in operation now as a result of gas volumes dropping in the Cook Inlets. That's certainly devastated to that area, and I think it sends I know it sends a strong message to the rest of the state of what can happen. If the scenario that concerns us is if we look down the road 10 years from now or 20 years from now, we're still luring additional incentives in front of all three producers, hoping that eventually it'll be something that all three will agree to, more facilities will close down. And the throughput of taps will even be that much lower. We'll be in a position of weakness. I don't think we're in a position of weakness now. I think we're in an incredible position of strength. I know that the ANGDA board, Scott Hayworth, as the chairman, is doing a. He contacted me and said, "Save your money. We're doing a value added study." And I'm always happy to say thank you to Scott and let them spend their money on things that benefit the state, which they do. So, they are doing a value added study, and I think it's going to show significant benefits to the state as a result of being able to utilize the liquids in Alaska. We've all seen the quotations from Premier Klein in Alberta talking about the pound of flesh out of this the Alaska gas line would be the liquids. We understand his motivations for that. I guess all I'm saying is that we should at least have the first crack at that to be able to have the manufacturing and additional infrastructure in the state.
Mr. Walker, from your organizational perspective, could you give us just a quick burst on the advantage of having an in-state gas provision as far as holding down the price of gas for in-state use in ACES?
The advantage of having lower gas yep. price in the state? Well, I think it's as we've certainly heard testimony within the legislature from legislators themselves of what constituents are paying for gas now, virtually double what they paid last year. I think that the whole economy is grinding to a halt as a result of that. If suddenly you're paying $1,000, $1,500 a month to heat your home, there are things you aren't going to do otherwise. So we think the advantage of in-state gas, even if it was, I mean, I think Fairbanks is now is at $25, headed to $28 per MCF for gas. Even if it was Henry Hub is like $8, and Alberta is like seven something. I mean, it's less there, but even that would be a huge, huge help. We live on much of Alaska is tied to diesel, and sometimes number one diesel when it's cold enough, and that's just pure gold as far as the cost of that. So I think the impact on the economy would be, and I think that's perhaps part of what ANGDA is going to do is show that in their value added. That is actually a value added as well. If suddenly a household is I mean, it's like getting a permanent dividend check every 3 months or every 2 months. And so I think that the impact of lower utility costs in Alaska would be absolutely would be felt very widespread.
Okay, thank you.
And again, the I'm perhaps repeating myself on this issue, but the Alaska autonomy, we like it that all the decisions on the permits and negotiations would be made within Alaska. We like that on the All-Alaska line. We think that's the way it should be done. We think we learned much from the TAPS experience, and we think that the more we can keep under our own control, the much better it is. On the YPC permits, I'm certainly not going to go through these, but I did want to just emphasize the period of time it took to obtain some of these. I mean, the longest was 8 years. The siting permit for the terminal is 7 years, and again, just renewed that last year. So, I mean, it's you know, is it you know, what this combination of 12 permits and right of way grants? It's hard to quantify exactly, but we know that we don't need to go out and get another right of way from the federal government or another one from the state of Alaska. We may need to update what we already have, but they seem to take our money every year. Just fine. So it's like a lease. It's like a rental payment. We pay for this. So it's there are no, I mean, this is going down the right of way of the most studied piece of earth we think on the earth. There have been three environmental impact statements for this route. Alyeska has done one. The renewal they did recently for the renewal of their renewal application, and Yukon Pacific has done one. So there's three. There are a few surprises along that route at this point, and that's what you want. When you're doing a project, we all know what the costs were on the delay of TAPS because of issues that were not resolved beforehand. Here you sit with the right-of-way permits that are in place and ready to go. So We think that's a huge, huge advantage. We really do. Craig's going to talk a little bit about this slide. This is the one where we show how it does not require all three producers, and we really think that's an exciting story for that we wanted to share, that actually came out of the work that we've just completed on the application.
Okay, Craig, put yourself on the record.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Craig Richards of Council, Walker and Levesque, Anchorage, Alaska. This slide communicates a lot of information, so I thought maybe a good way to start would be in the bottom right-hand corner, which essentially is how much gas you need for a 2, a 2.7, and a 4.5 BCF project. We see that for the 4.5 project, you need about 50 TCF. For the 2.7 project, which is the Port Authority's base case that was presented in the G application, you need about 30 TCF. And then for the smaller yet still economically viable project, you need a little over 20 TCF. And then I believe TransCanada said in their application that they could go as low as 3.5 BCF and still have a viable project. So that's going to be about 40 TCF of gas. Now, the top left-hand box demonstrates right now in Alaska, in Prudhoe and Point Thompson, there's about 33.5 of proven reserves. With Kuparuk, you can maybe add another one, so you're at about 35 TCF. Now, to finance a pipeline, our financing folks are telling us you need 30 years of proven reserves. So even at the lowest viable flow-through rate for TransCanada, we're still short about 5 TCF. So even if we can prove that up in time for the project to go, you're still in a situation where you need full participation by the state of Alaska and all three producers. Now, what is interesting about the 2 BCF project that's viable at 20 TCF is what's happened in Point Thompson in the last year. And if you go to the top right-hand slide, we'll now show who the major gas holders are in Alaska. When those 9 TCF reverted from Exxon, BP, Chevron, and to a small extent ConocoPhillips back to the state, which they will when title is cleared in 2009, the state went from being the fourth largest gas controller in the state to the largest gas controller. The state of Alaska now owns 36% of the gas outright produced at the wellhead. That means they have one-third of the gas to commit to a pipeline to bring to market. That's 12 TCF. You're already 60% at a viable project. You've got 60% of the gas that the state of Alaska itself can commit. So that means if you go down the list, get to 20 CCF, you really only need one other producer. You need Exxon or you need Conoco, or maybe BP and a little extra you find somewhere else. So essentially, you can do a 2 BCF project that's economic with the state and one of the producers.
Once more, on market optionality, we believe that the first market is the Alaskan consumers. We have ability to take gas in Lower 48, and there are three ways we do that. We do that as the enabling pipeline for a later highway project, assuming that gas goes into the Lower 48. I'm not sure that it does, but assuming it does. Secondly, through LNG to the West Coast is a second way to the terminals on the West Coast. And the third way that has been explained to us by the marketing people we work with is gas, LNG is swapped regularly, oil is swapped regularly, that the location of Alaska into the world market and shipping of LNG, that we would be able to make swaps that would put gas into, or LNG into the east coast of the continental U.S. as well as into the west coast. So we think that there are three ways that we can get gas into the U.S. But again, it really depends upon the person shipping the gas. I mean, there's nothing that says when the gas goes into the pipeline at Prudhoe Bay where they have to take it to. They can take, the only thing limits them as far as export license and those issues. But even on a Canadian line, there's nothing that says where it's going to go. I mean, they can offtake it in Alberta. They can offtake it wherever they want, or they can leave it in, go all the way to Chicago, or even into the Gulf Coast state. So, we are not. Our job, we think, in Alaska, is to make sure that they have the most market optionality as far as where that gas is going to go. And what all this comes down to is for a successful open season. And we think a successful open season is one that is a smaller project, can be done without all three producers, and goes in and has market optionality to go into any part of the world they want to take the product to. This is the once again the emphasizing or reemphasizing perhaps the higher wellhead with the LNG with the All Alaska project and a and the reason for that obviously is the market that we've looked at. And again, the market we've looked at is the market we believe is going to get gas to Alaskans first. Henry Hub in the Asian market the price is Henry Hub plus $3. In the Alberta market is Henry Hub minus 75 cents. That's an average, and it runs out to 20 years past construction. It ranges between $2 additional in Henry Hub to as high as $4. So that's an average that has run that out. This is a number that's been obtained by a number of sources, some with the entities that we're working with in that market, some from some of the public energy companies in Japan that are forecasting what it's going to be out into the 20 years past the construction date, completion date. The information in the various trade journals that support that, there are four ways that we have vetted that number to make sure we haven't just picked a number and put that before you. That's a result of an awful lot of work on behalf of our consultants to do that. We thought it was helpful to show you the things that we don't require. I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about what we need, what we require. This is a list of things that we don't require. We don't require a bridge shipper at the open season. We don't think there'll be a failed open season because the size of the open season is 2.7. It's within the current offtake at Prudhoe Bay under Rule 9, under the AOGCC rules. It's a volume that we believe will not. Does not require, and according to AOGCC, I'm sorry, does not require an oil mitigation plan.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. On that point, Bill, if you didn't have one of the producers, the math wouldn't work to 2.7. So my question is, have you, thinking about an open season, have you looked at the unit agreements? And do you feel confident that the way they're structured, that one producer could break out of the pack and bid to be a part of that 2.7?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, we have looked at that, and fortunately, that's a good question. Thank you for that. And the person who's looked at it most is sitting next to me. So, Craig, if you would answer that, please.
Sure. I've looked at it, and it has been a year, so I might not have all the details right, like sections and whatnot. But basically, the Prudhoe Bay operating agreement is where you would typically find the gas balancing provision among the operators that allows one operator to remove its gas while the others maintain their gas in the reservoir. The Prudhoe Bay operating agreement does not have a viable gas balancing provision, and that's unacceptable. It should have one, and the state should require them to have one. Federal law is very clear that it is an antitrust violation for one producer to keep another producer from getting his gas to markets by not agreeing to a gas balancing provision. Additionally, there have been a number of cases in Louisiana and Texas where those have been held to be breach of lease terms and your implied duty to get gas to market, basically. So the state of Alaska, in my opinion, has the legal right through the AOGCC or DNR with the adoption of regulations to create a default gas balancing provision, and I think it should do so. And my guess is if they did that, that would motivate the producers to come up with their own.
Interesting. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank
Please
you.
Continue.
We have not... as we mentioned before, we have not put in for the federal loan guarantee in this project because we think it's an uphill battle with the limitation. Even though certainly the ability to go into the continental U.S. if someone chose to take it there, we think it raises some questions that we don't want the delay associated with that. We think that obviously the issue on the all three producers, no single producer can be a. A veto, and we've watched over the years. We've watched the sort of the interplay between the three, as far as some want to go over the top, have for years, and have been very clear about that. And I've always appreciated that. They said, here's our preference. Here's what it's going to take." We watched closely the stranded gas act negotiations and sort of what it would take to bring them from the over the top and whatnot. So. We don't require additional gas discoveries prior to open season. I think that's important. One thing we've been advised is that the financial market does not take reserve risk. They want to make sure it's proved reserves. You know, Commissioner Irwin is very clear and has always been very vocal that there's plenty of gas for all the projects, and we don't dispute that. We think that's absolutely correct. But proved reserves means something different in when you're going out to finance a $20 billion project. You want to make sure you, I mean, they're going to want, no one's going to want to take that risk on proved reserves. We have the proved reserves for the 2 and certainly for the 2.7 as well. So it does not require any additional exploration on that as well. And that certainly could be a reason that a large open season may not be successful. Someone could come in and say, well, we just don't have the reserves. How are we supposed to confirm a firm transportation commitment, you know, for 30 years for gas that we haven't discovered yet? How are we going to do that? So that concerns us a lot as far as the volume. We know that once there's a pipeline available to get the gas out of Alaska, I mean, there's exploration now. We know there'll be additional. But right now, there's not. In 18 months, I'm not sure there's going to be additional reserves that will be proved reserves enough for a 4.5 BCF project open season. You know, we just don't, you know, we're not picking on one project or the other, but we certainly feel that our issues, land issues in Alaska have been resolved, and they have not been resolved completely in line through Canada. We think that's why, in fact, at one point, in meetings I've had with two companies that were looking at going through Canada, I said perhaps the best thing that you would ever have happen for a Canadian line would be for there to be an all-Alaska line. Suddenly there was some reason to resolve some issues if the all-Alaska line, if there's two options. Right now, if it's all through one location, negotiation could drag on for a long time. But if suddenly they realize it's not going to go through their backyard or their front yard, then they may come back to the table on some of the issues that have been dragging out in Canada. So, and of course, on the state and federal right-of-ways, we already have those. We don't need to apply for those again. We already have those with the YPC permits are available, and then the export license as well. We don't need to go ask for an export license. There's one certainly valid. On the gas line incentives, I have sort of made a bit of a study of this. I went back to 85, and after I did it, I sort of wish I hadn't, because I was so frustrated at all the efforts that you folks have made, that predecessors have made in putting together incentive packages that would cause there to be a gas pipeline. And started off with sort of in 92 with sort of pressure and commitments and studies and you know, I've got all the coffee cups from all the different studies that were announced and all the different, you know, the sponsor group on this and all this other stuff and you know, it's just, you know, it's when you read all that in a half a day, you end up being kind of angry when you get done, because you see the cycle. You see the cycle of what happens is that you go through an administration and it starts off, everybody is, we're going to build a gas line. We all want to build a gas line, of course we do. And it sort of starts the process of the teams are formed on various sides, and then the concessions are put together, and then studies are done, and then nothing happens. A change of administration, it's like a line change in hockey. You know, the people on both sides are gone, and they start back and say, now, let's talk about building a gas line. Now, let's put a team together. Let's have some incentive. And then at some point, you have to say, enough's enough. And I think that now that Alaska has moved into the number one position as controlling interest in gas, I think Alaska should stay. Enough is enough. The incentive process has not worked. We have not, and even the $13.25 billion that was valued that the Stranded Gas Act would have cost the state, even that didn't result in a commitment to build a pipeline. It was a commitment to sit down and work really, really hard towards one, but it wasn't a commitment to build a pipeline. So even that, when we're actually presenting, and thank you for not accepting it, but when contracts are being, you know, being drafted that would cost us, you know, $13.25 billion, what are we doing? You know, we watch closely with the energy bill in Washington, on the federal energy bill, as far as what was required in there and what was taken out. The price floor was taken out. President Bush testified he would say that he would take it out himself. Did not believe that was appropriate. And the number of trade associations, natural gas trade associations in the lower 48 that came forth and said, absolutely not. We will not have our tax dollars used to subsidize a gas line from Alaska and in the price floor. So that was taken out with a lot of passion from the lower 48. So when I see issues associated with bridge shipping, I don't get a lot of warmth that's actually going to happen because of what happened very quickly on the price floor that was presented.
So I guess, you know, and my final thing on the incentives is, again, our incentives are just, we don't need any, you know, we weren't created because we were going to apply for the Stranded Gas Act. We applied for the Stranded Gas Act. And the administration said, you know, you guys don't belong here because you're not asking for any incentives. I said, yeah, we understand that. We have all the incentives, thank you very much. So we did something different on a protocol agreement with that. You know, we didn't get involved in the AGIA process because we want the incentives. We want $500 million of funds. We're in this for the long haul. It's just a little longer haul than we thought it was going to be, but we're staying the course because the Alaska project is the one that's closest to being built and has the fewest hurdles to do. So that's, and the incentive are on a monthly basis. Our costs of utilities are just skyrocketing, and we've got to do something.
We're looking for the new generation of coffee cups.
Well,
yeah, please continue.
We've been hesitant to do that, Mr. Chairman. Seriously, because we have the other ones. We have the sponsor group. We got all the other different study groups that have gone together, and you know, the last study group, I can't remember what they gave out. I think it was hats or something. But I mean, enough. What we're saying is enough of this. We are now at a point that I think we figured it out ourselves. You know, you wait long enough and you get hungry enough, you figure out a solution to this, and we think we have. And it doesn't involve the Port Authority. And we're not here to say we're the smartest guys on the block. Clearly we're not. But we're here we have studied this for 10 years. We have seen the pressures that have been applied to us to not be successful in the AGIA process. We see the pressures that have been applied to Mid-America. We see the only one that can't be pressured is you. You are the only ones that cannot be, that can stand up and say, we're going to do this. You know, I am getting ahead of myself. I'm not. Actually, I'm not. I'm not getting ahead of myself. I spoke with, like I said, I spent most of the summer in Houston, and I spent most of the time in meetings with large companies that are in this business, that either in the LNG business or in the exploration business on the slope currently. At one point, I proposed to them, this was after the pipeline partner sort of slipped away for mysterious reasons, whatever, that's, you know, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but anyway, they were gone. I said, well, what would you think if the state of Alaska participated, and as participated in a significant way in just the pipeline piece of it? I said, well, how would that work? Their response, they said that would be, for them, would be the most significant statement that a project was going to happen. That would mean there would be absolute true alignment of interest, because the state of Alaska wants a lower tariff. A shipper of gas wants a lower tariff. The state of Alaska makes more revenue on a lower tariff, a higher wellhead price. So they went through a discussion that I mean, it must come from because of the place that they work. They said, in most national oil companies, that's the way it happened. When the government, host government, says we're going to be involved and we're going to have an open season, they said, let me tell you something about an open season. When the host government is involved, you show up. That's not when the government, that entity that renews your plan of development, your POD every 12 months, you show up at their open season. If it's some third party, there's all sorts of reasons not to show up in an open season. But when it's the sovereign that's holding the open season, you show up. When it's within the volume of gas that you're re-injecting that's allowed to be taken off without any oil mitigation, you show up. They said that it would be a very significant step forward in assurance that there would be a project. One of the concerns they stated was, we're always afraid that the value, that the gaming that can go on in the pipeline piece. We saw that when Conoco left years ago, and Archie Dunham, the chairman, said it broke his heart to leave Alaska and to transfer the interest over to BP. He said, but we don't own a piece of the pipeline, and we were losing all the value in the pipeline. So, like someone in Calgary told me once in his office, he said, has Alaska learned nothing in 30 years about how it should work as far as the pipeline piece? That's the piece that we should have at least a 51% ownership in that pipeline, because that's what we want it to be, the lowest tariff. Mm-hmm. And so I took that conversation from that company and said, well, let's run with that a bit. Let's see how that would work. We really hadn't thought about that. We've been busy trying to find you know, pipeline company A and B and C. And one thing we learned is they said, you know, most pipeline companies said, we don't want to be involved just the pipeline piece. You know, that's a regulated return. It's not really all that exciting. We want to be involved in the upstream. We want a slice of the project. We want a piece of the upstream as well as the midstream and the downstream. And we don't want to be the one stuck with just the pipeline. So now I realize, okay, the pipeline piece is the piece that's the tough piece. So, I mean, I kind of look at it as though if we had a gold mine, which we do, up in Prudhoe Bay, and we had a market for it, we just couldn't get it out, we'd build a road. We'd absolutely build a road. We'd build I refer to this as the third lane of the Richardson Highway and the Dalton Highway. We would do that in a minute. We absolutely believe the state should take a significant role in the pipeline piece of it. We have been advised that if the state did, the interest in the consortium for a liquefaction piece at that point would be there's a lot of interest now. Because I have shared this concept with companies that we've been working with. They said, Bill, if the state of Alaska stepped forward on a significant player in the pipeline piece, absolutely we'd be interested, extremely interested in this. So we think there's a significant incentive for that to happen, because we know what has not worked. And again, remember, you know, we're not here promoting the Port Authority. We're not here saying it has to be done through the Port Authority. Actually, we're here to say we think you are the best ones to jumpstart this to happen. To say the incentive parade has stopped. It's over. There'll be no more incentives. We're going to do a pipeline. We're going to be doing an all-Alaska pipeline, and we're going to start now. Now, who wants to be a participant in that? We'll go through the economics of it, not to the point it'll get past your target date, I don't think, but to show what that would cost. I think you'll be surprised how little it would cost for us to be a participant in that piece of it.
Yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. The only problem is we don't have the expertise. I mean, I've thought this through a few times myself, and because of our state procurement code, because we're still the United States of America, I mean, we can't really behave the way sovereigns do internationally into sort of getting things done. And so from both the construction point of view, if you're at 51%, and the operating point of view, I mean, no disrespect to our state and our state employees, but I just see it as a terribly inefficient business model.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, I certainly understand your concerns, and I guess I would say is that I would not envision that there would be a state employee involved in this, and I no disrespect to state employees. You would go out and retain the experts that it takes to do this. I mean, there are a number of examples of projects like this that other states have gotten involved in. One that comes to mind, and we do have a slide on that showing. You know, you sort of look at what we are involved in Alaska, and it's pretty sophisticated. There are those that certainly wouldn't have thought that the permanent fund would be as successful as it is. I know we have a railroad. Most states don't have a railroad. I mean, we have pieces of infrastructure that other states might not have, just because there are others that are there that are doing that piece of it. You know, we took a look at what California did when they had a water shortage in Southern California. There was a lot of discussion about whether or not California should get involved in the private sector area of moving water. After a couple of water shortages, significant water shortages, they went out and bonded themselves for a couple billion dollars to build about a 600-mile aqueduct system. All the water in California was in the northern part of California. The population was in the southern. So they put together this 48-inch pipeline, aqueduct, canals, to move the water. They now have 25,000 customers, and it feeds the agricultural, it moves it to where it needs to be. So when I saw, and we spoke with them at length about the process they went through, the concerns were raised, and we're not at all unlike yours, saying, what are we getting involved in this for? We have no business in this. The private sector should do this. Someone finally said, the private sector is not going to do it. And because they're not going to do that piece of it, we're going to have a problem. And so they stepped in and they did that. Now, that was started in the early 1960s. Today, if they did that, that would be about a $12 or $15 billion project to do that. So we see examples elsewhere that states have gotten. I mean, our situation is that our gas is in the northern region, and our population is in the markets out or in the southern region. So I think that's a fairly decent analogy of what we should do. And I don't think that we should not do it Because right now, you're absolutely correct, Senator McGuire. We do not have the expertise today as we sit here. But believe me, the expertise is there. And what I have been told by many is, you know, it's a piece of pipe with two compressor stations. Yes, there's some detail, and you know, you would want to have, obviously, you'd want to have the right pipeline company doing it as the builder and as the operator. Of course you would. And I'm not saying that we do everything in-house. I'd say we do it like any other.
Mr. Walker, in the interest of time, well, I think we have your point of Alaska participation. Are there any other highlights you want to hit on that particular part?
There are. And I'll move quickly, Mr. Chairman. We do have a couple of slides about the state ownership as far as what that would entail, and I'm going to ask Craig to move through that quickly.
And I'll do so. In looking at this and really trying to identify the leverage point, the weak point, which is exactly what the Port Authority tried to do with Point Thompson, and it's the same thing with the gas balancing provision. Find the weak points that are preventing a gas line from going and strengthen them. And the pipeline portion is the weak point here. That's what the project needs help with, because that's where we're having the hardest time getting investors interested. The 51% state, it'd be basically what we're suggesting is the state take a 51% equity interest in a $12 billion pipeline. That means after 75% of it is paid for by debt, the state has about a $1.5 billion investment in the pipeline. That gives it majority control of that pipeline. Now, there's risk exposure that comes with that, up to about $6 billion, because during construction, you essentially are on the hook for the debt payments. This is typical project finance construction for pipelines. When the pipeline is being constructed, the equity investors have to cover those debt payments if they're not made. So that means your risk exposure is up to, in this case, half of the debt cost of the pipeline. After construction is finished and gas is flowing, the equity holders are no longer online for that debt. So effectively, for $1.5 billion, the state of Alaska could move a pipeline forward, be a majority owner, and during the construction window only, have risk exposure up to about $6 billion. And frankly, as we say in point five, there's a very, very good chance that $6 billion risk exposure can be mitigated significantly through various financing mitigation provisions. And then the next slide basically goes through and shows various public corporations that the state has. And it shows you that the $1.5 billion that the state needs to move a pipeline forward is not significant in light of other public corporations already in operation. You know, when the permanent fund was created, there was a debate whether or not the permanent fund should be a development bank, or whether it should be run as an independent endowment fund, like a pension fund. And ultimately, of course, the independent endowment fund concept won out. The permanent fund is not a development bank. It doesn't reinvest its funds in Alaska. But in the alternative, ADA, the bond bank, and AHSC were all created to fulfill that development role. And that's exactly what all three of those organizations do, among these others. And for instance, HFC was capitalized at almost $1 billion back in the 80s. That's about as much as we need to get a pipeline moving forward. So we don't think it's either out of keeping with the history of the state or out of keeping with reasonable risk exposure for the state to put up $1.5 billion to get this pipeline going.
The way forward. I promise you we'd have a recommendation, and here's our recommendation. Here's the way we see it. We've studied with this, and then I actually had a board meeting in Fairbanks on Saturday. The first is just to leave things as they are. As they are, the way we see them playing out is that there will be an application brought to you sometime at the end of this session, maybe in a special session, for a Canadian project. We think that that's pretty much a foregone conclusion. At that point, you would have the opportunity to approve it, vote it up or down. And we think that's probably the realistic scenario of how that's going to play out. Option two would be, if that contract is brought to you, if you voted it down, did not approve the contract, that would, in essence, bring you a GEA 2. It would move you into a GEA 2. Under a GEA, the laws that's written now, it basically would roll into another scenario that the administration would reassess. They would come back out for more additional RFPs or RFAs, whatever they call them, and begin the process over. We think that at a minimum, the cost would be 1 year. And there's many other costs associated with that, but it'd be a minimum of 1 year for that to happen. So for there to be in a GEA 2. Sometimes when you come back and redo something you've done before, you get fewer bidders than you did before. They wonder how serious is this, is it bid shopping, et cetera. We're not recommending a GEA 2. We are recommending option 3, and that's basically a parallel process. Not particularly unprecedented. With what you've done before. In the past, the legislature has retained its own experts to do an analysis of the Stranded Gas Act and other things, and I guess that's where our recommendation for you would be for you to retain experts at this point to evaluate that which is not in a GEA. Your hands are not tied or limited in any way because of a GEA. This is not, it would not affect a GEA. But we think that you would want, we would hope that you would want to be as independently and absolutely as informed as possible about what all the options are available to you, rather than sort of up or down on one application. And again, I don't say that being critical of the administration in any way or the process. I'm just saying the purpose of a GEA was to do what's best for Alaska, and I think there's ways that we can still accomplish that, even with the limitation the GEA has right now. At that point, assuming you would go to a special session, you could do one of two things. You could award to a Canadian project, or you can adopt legislation for an all-Alaska project. But we're not asking you to take any legislative action at this point, or amending a GEA at this point. We're not recommending that. But we are recommending that you retain independent experts to do a full and robust analysis of the all-Alaska line. I think Alaskans are anxious for that to be done. I even on the plane coming down last night, sitting next to somebody who didn't know me at all, about the third thing he said to me was talking about the reconsideration. I thought, my goodness, I was stunned at the level of concern across the state about what's happening on the what's not happening on the All Alaska. And I don't think anybody is casting any aspersions on anybody as a result of that. Just we're in a tough situation. And I would just hope that all we see forward, I mean, we are really adamant that we believe that the best way forward is the state of Alaska as the majority controlling interest in our natural resources in the North Slope to step forward and say, we're going to do a project. Who's in? But we also think you need to do a full analysis, and unless you want to just take our word for it, take a full analysis of experts to verify basically what we have presented. So that would be our, I guess that's where I would leave it with our, that's our ask, I would say, in this presentation.
And you're going to allow us the benefit of your research?
Absolutely. Everything we have would be available. Absolutely.
Good questions, Mr. Walker? Well, good. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Sorry about the time crunch, but, and just by way of explanation, there was a question about, were we going to do Port Authority earlier on, and we were just holding off until your reconsideration had been completed before we did the invitation.
And Mr. Chairman, we appreciate that timing of that very much. That's very helpful, and thank you again very much for this opportunity today.
Yep, okay, thank you. Thank you, Craig. Yep. And with that, we're adjourned.